is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, Hoopheads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish Home Machine, which is perfect for these crazy times when gyms and schools are closed. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Gannon Baker, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering new subscribers 10% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code SAVE10 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its play bank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. Tonight, we are pleased to welcome back to the podcast for his 8th appearance, which I think makes him the number one all-time guest in appearances, Greg White from Bentonville West High School in the state of Arkansas for 4 quarters, number 7. Greg, welcome back.
It's good to be back. Last time, you know, we were chatting before, last time we did this, we didn't know if we'd have anything to talk about anymore for a while. And so the fact we've all wrapped up a season and we got NCAA women playing on TV tonight and men will be back on this weekend. It's a good time to be talking basketball. So thanks for having me, guys. Always enjoy it. Always enjoy talking basketball with you guys for sure.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun, I think, tonight to talk. And certainly we feel a lot better about where things are with the whole pandemic situation than we did back in the fall when we were first talking and seemed like, man, we didn't even know if we were going to get a season. And then before we jumped on here and went live, you talked about your team getting an opportunity to play 31 games. I talked about my son here in the state of Ohio playing his freshman season out and getting to play 22 games, which is the max you can play here. And I think if you would have told any of us back in September, October that that was what was going to happen, first of all, we'd have been pretty dubious that that was actually going to take place. And if you'd have told us that it was, we'd be sitting here the same way we are today, which is pretty thankful that we had the opportunity to go through our season and for our kids to be able to participate and play. And as you said, Greg, we know there's places in the country where the kids didn't get an opportunity to play out their season. And it's been a tough year. I mean, even the teams that got to play, there were certainly challenges, but we made it through in some cases. And it's always nice to have basketball back and certainly nice to have March Madness back. And it's always great to talk hoops.
It's tip-off time with Coach Greg White.
So we are going to jump right into our first quarter. And the first quarter is related to what we've just been talking about here off the top. And that is, what are some things that we've done as coaches during COVID that we think are going to stick around once COVID is over? So what are some things that you had to do, invented, needed to do this year with COVID that maybe you didn't do in the past that you think are going to stick around, that are going to be beneficial to you as a coach and to your program moving forward?
You know, that's a great topic. And like we've talked and we all spent the spring. I saw a tweet from Fran Fraschilla, I believe it was 2 days ago, talking about how great all the basketball looks in the NCAA tournament. It's because coaches actually had time to plan. And I think we all did that. I think we all spent the spring in conversations with other coaches and studying. Obviously, college coaches weren't out recruiting. High school coaches weren't, you know, planning summer camps. And everyone just kind of got back and kind of cleaned up the playbook, you know. And so one of the things we did with COVID was we spent a lot of time trying to grow, you know, as a staff and teaching our players how to grow outside of just practice time. And I think that's going to be beneficial for a lot of people. You know, speaking from our program side, we learned that, you know, I think every program has a parent meeting. I think everyone does, you know, their ability to communicate. We found, based on kind of like how everyone else was doing, Zooms, Google Meets, you can save so much time and make it so much more accessible to parents by using those. I think we will never have an in-person, you know, what we call the big parent meeting where everyone comes in one room. We'll probably do that some just for the camaraderie and honestly just because we couldn't last year. But I think anytime we're going to pass information, we were doing weekly parent meetings with players, even if they're only 30 minutes, but they were to share, you know, what we were discussing, what was coming. And so that was a big thing for us, just learning how to save time, and how to keep our parents involved and keep connected when we weren't connected. You know, that was the thing that we were all searching for, that personal connection, because when you get sent home after the first week, you know, as much as we all love our families, it got real tiresome for all of us. We were all trying to find a way to reconnect. And so I think that's one of the ways that I think that's something that needs to stay for everybody is, you know, the parent communication with Google Meets. You know, we joke about why every meeting we've had that could have been an email. We've all seen that we can do it now. And that's a big thing for us with communicating with our parents for sure.
Were you doing those weekly meetings before, or was that something that you just added because it was simply easier to do once you kind of mastered the Google Meet technology?
I think it was something we added because we were still in the situation, you know, thankfully here in Arkansas, we opened up in July. We were able to start practicing in small groups and then large group. But I think back then, even we still didn't believe we were going to play. I think we were at the point we were doing things because we felt like we were supposed to be doing them, and we were trying to return to some form of structure. And then we started realizing we were trying to communicate as much as we could. And one of the things you guys know, Mike Neighbors is a good friend of mine, and we talked a lot during this time, that it was frustrating for coaches because we're always used to operating in the know. And there were so many more people that knew more than we did at the time. And so for us, we felt that if we got information, we wanted to share it with our parents as quick as we could. And so Google Meets and Zoom became the easiest way to do that. And then you start realizing that you could connect people on their own time. You know, you can record them. I mean, I've always been a proponent. We've always recorded our recorded our meetings. It's funny, that's Mike Neighbors calling right now.
Hey, have him jump on.
Yeah.
Patch him in.
We always, we talked about just trying to communicate and keep things going like that. But we've always recorded our meetings, and this is a great way to do that now because Google does it for you. And so if a parent misses a meeting, you can host it, you know, say the information you need to say. It's all recorded. It's all saved. It covers your rear end in the situation. But it also makes it for people can be apart when they're not there. And that was what I think we learned the most about COVID, was you can still be connected even though you're not together.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it became much easier to be able to connect with people. And as you said, I know one of the things that we talked about, and we've talked about it, I think, on a couple episodes of Four Quarters, when you talked about your parent meeting, and you always recommend, hey, videotape that thing so that there's proof out there that, hey, we talked about this and you can see it. Here it is right here. Here's me talking about this particular standard or this particular aspect of our program. And so for you to say that I didn't know about it just is patently untrue because here it is on video. And so to be able to have the opportunity to do that, and obviously as we all become more comfortable with the tools, especially as teachers, you had no choice but to become comfortable with the tools that you needed to teach virtually in some cases and all those things. It just makes it so much easier to be able to do those types of meetings than trying to do it all in person, which is almost impossible.
Yeah, and you know, and we everyone's got busy lives, and people are juggling family, and you know, I always feel bad when a parent would come, you know, have to apologize for missing a meeting. Well, now they don't have to miss it, and they get to see it, and so it was a great thing. I think one of the biggest things I learned with COVID, because we our players were apart for so long, and they, you know, I can talk about what we did throughout our season, some of the measures we took to make sure we played, but I had to lighten up a little bit in practice, meaning our players didn't have that social time. They didn't have the walking to the, they didn't have the walk into class to talk to somebody, you know, because everything was so structured and meant everything was in place to make sure we had a season. We kind of started missing out on the fact that they're kids still. And so, you know, if we would make time in practice just to, our water break may have went from a minute and 30 to 4 minutes just so they could sit and talk. And, you know, if you caught them talking in the line in a drill or laughing, you know, you had to let them, I started to realize they needed that more than they needed me, you know, talking about something. And so we tried to add more of a social aspect to our practices as well, which I think is good. You know, I mean, that's why they're there. They're there to have fun. They're there to try to win games, but they're also there because it's their friends. And so we added that social aspect, and really, really important, I think, for some of us to, you know, lighten up a little bit on that stuff. And that was something important to us. And then finally, just being grateful. You know, we like I said, we played 31 games this year. I think it was a total of 180 days. We were involved in basketball from practice to the end. And just the gratefulness, not complaining about being tired at practice. You know, we had those days, and there were days I had to battle it and our players had to battle it. But when you think about our friends that were in states that didn't get to play, we told our guys, you know, and we never knew the fear of could we get shut down again at any moment. Could just the gratefulness of getting to play basketball was such a peaceful feeling for this season that, yeah, you know, you hate when your season ends, but what a triumph for those young men. I told them, I said, you know, you played a season when a lot of people in the world didn't want you to play and most people didn't think you would play, and we did it. And so that was a winning season for us, most definitely.
Greg, do you think that the huddle cams and the live streaming stuff's going to stay going forward? Or do you think...
I think that was
when I first thought of this, like one of this topic, that was the kind of thing that I was thinking of was the most valuable thing, because like you were able to, anyone was able to watch a game, like even if they couldn't go to the game, you know, anyone was able to watch games this year, which hasn't necessarily been always true. So yeah. I think that's really going to be valuable going forward, in my opinion.
Yeah. You know, we've been very fortunate. Our athletic director, Scott Passmore, is such a forward thinker. We've been streaming games for 5 years. And so when this hit, you know, it wasn't a switch for us. It was just, let's increase our capability. You know, we started streaming more of our freshman games and things like that. But it was, I love it. I mean, speaking from the athletic side, if you can sell an ad, you know, we're going to do it. I think it's going to increase. You know, I love the fact that, you know, now, you know, grandma can watch the game from three states away. I think that's important. I think it's awesome for our kids. And I think it's great for our fans, too, that, you know, when they were disconnected and couldn't be there because of the restrictions for attendance, they were still apart. I was still getting text messages about, hey, watch your game tonight. But I tell you what I really believe. As we return more to our structure and, you know, our way of bouncing back, I mean, I think gyms are going to be packed. I think Friday night football in the fall, there's going to be bigger crowds than we've ever seen or imagined. I hope there are anyway, because I think the kids deserve it, but I think our communities deserve it. And so I'm excited about that. We've had changes in our restrictions here. I just saw the Big Ten's, you know, taken away for spring sports. I mean, when the weather, you know, it's a little different weather in Big Ten country than it is in the South, but, you know, I can't wait to go sit at a baseball game. I can't wait to, you know, be go to a track meet, watch kids compete, go to soccer, just just getting that feeling. And I don't try to use the word normalcy because I that's kind of the fallback thing, but just the structure and stability is the word I prefer, is the stability of our community, stability of athletics. That's what's making everything seem right. You know, we got two great tournaments going on in NCAA. I wish people could be in the crowd, but if you're watching these athletes compete, man, it's, you know, that means something to them, and everyone's tuning in their TV and yelling and rooting, and it's just the stability sports gives a community, and you guys know this. That's what we're missing, and that's what we want to get back.
I agree. I think it's going to be really exciting to see and have the opportunity to go back and watch games live, and I got to go and sit in my son's freshman games, but then I had to leave the gym, so I didn't get to see the JV team. I didn't get to see the varsity team, but I could watch it, to Jason's point, I could watch it streaming. And the nice part for me about the streaming side of it was, for a long time, my parents live in Florida, and so they don't get to see my kids really play much of anything. They might see some grainy video that I shot on the phone, or they might get to see some photos, whatever. But to be able to watch an actual live stream event, I just send my dad a text and say, "Hey, Dad, you know, game's at 5 o'clock today. If you want to check it out." And then some days he'd be like, "Sure, I'm going to watch it at 5. But then other days he'd be like, "Well, Mom and I are heading out to dinner and we'll watch it later on tonight." And the fact that you can, the fact that you can watch it, you know, whenever you want. And obviously there's no chance of him running across the score and spoiling the game and knowing what the outcome is before he watches it. It was just another great way for me to be connected and for them to be connected to their grandson. It's just, it's something that wasn't capable. You know, you look back in the past and it just wasn't possible. And you guys were a little bit ahead of the curve, but for us, this was the first year that that was really made available. And it's a little bit weird. What I found to be the weirdest thing was that there are no more kids standing up in the stands, fumbling with the video camera and trying to figure out how to make it work and making their innocuous comments about the other people who they're filming in the games. That's the one thing I'll probably miss. I'm sure we all have a good story or two about that, of, you know, you're sitting there watching the film with your team and all of a sudden the manager or the player from one of the other teams that's filming makes some comment about, "Hey, this guy," you know, that was always entertainment, both as a player and as a coach. I always look forward to those miscues by the film crew.
Exactly. Those are, you know, it was funny how we kind of got spoiled by it, because we were all in the mood, like, we just want to play. We just want to play. Well, then it became, when competition kicked in, we were wanting to get that edge. And we were, you know, there were some leagues in our area that wouldn't allow you to bring your filmer because, you know, they were trying to social distance and stuff. Well, then it became, well, what happens if that one camera dies or if the kid messes up? And so it was funny on the coaching side to see how we went from, "I'll do anything in the world to make sure our teams play," to the minute they said, "You're playing," and it went right back to, "I'll do anything it takes to win." And that's when I told everybody I knew we were back. I knew we were back when everyone quit, you know, being the guy that, "Oh, we'll do whatever. We're just so happy to play," that it went back to, "Well, now, but my team's getting that." But I'll tell you this, maybe I'm the outsider on this. You guys can weigh in. But I don't want to go back to post-game handshakes. You know, we did the point wave this year, and I loved it. You know,
I'm 100%. I am, Greg. I couldn't be more in agreement with you on this. I could not be more in agreement. I think
there's more trouble that comes from post-game handshakes, in my opinion, than there's
absolutely
worth.
Good. Absolutely.
And you guys know this. Brad's been a guest on here. Brad Stamps. We coach together. He's one of my brothers. We love each other. They beat us on a last second shot this year. Totally my fault. I messed that game up where we lose at the buzzer. And as much as I love him, he was able to handle it with his team, and I was able just to get my kids out of there. There was none of that stain, you know, because their kids had a big shot. Their kids rushed the floor. They're jumping up and down. And you guys have been there. I've been on both sides of it. It's an awkward feeling to make your kids quit celebrating to go shake hands.
Absolutely.
And it's an awkward, it's even worse to stand there and watch and wait for them. So we were able to, you know, obviously me and Brad connected after the game. We talked for a long time, but it was just, you know, and it's just that's when all the bad stuff. So I'm pushing for the FIBA model. You know, let's line up, let's shake hands with everybody before the game. You can actually mean, "Hey, I hope you have a great game." Then you go out and hit each other in the mouth, and then you point and you wave and you leave, because that way, you know, and I've had people tell me, you're just, again, that's not good sportsmanship. Sportsmanship's how you play. It's not a ritual. It's how you play and how you respect the game, respect your opponent. You know, I can go on. That's a totally different subject.
But listen, coaching middle school girls, the only thing, you know, everything happens on the floor. But the second you go to shake hands at the end of the game, you know, someone's going to call someone a nasty name. Someone's going to do something. And then it just becomes a whole thing. And I couldn't agree with you more, Greg. I don't want to shake hands at the end of games.
Yeah. No, it's so nice. It takes what is normally a 2-minute procedure that is just fraught with worry as a coach of, you hope that you've got your team to the point where they're not going to do anything. But the number of times that I've had players of mine come back to me after the handshake line and say, number 7 pulled their hand back from everybody when they were walking through the line, or this person said X, Y, or Z to 3 of our players, or I know I've had at least one time where a player said that another player spit on them. Like, yeah. I don't want to deal with that. There's no, as you said, Greg, it's a ritual. It doesn't really mean anything in terms of sportsmanship. And it's a really difficult thing to ask. And again, you can take it down to 8-year-olds up to high school seniors. It's a really difficult thing to ask a kid who has just won a game to temper themselves down and walk through that line. And at the same time, for a kid who's just lost, it's very difficult for them to walk through that line and shake the hand and put on a semi-happy face, at least as they walk through that line. It's, to me, in a lot of ways, it's disingenuous to the true emotions that are going on. And I just think, hey, why are we teaching kids to suppress that just so we can touch hands? It's much easier for me to point and wave to the other coach, hey, good game. The two teams can kind of wave at each other if they really want to. Otherwise, let's just move to our respective locker rooms or to our respective hallways or wherever it is that we're headed and avoid all the potential pitfalls that go with shaking hands. So I couldn't agree with you more on that one.
Yeah, and I hope that's the one thing that sticks. You know, we had a state tournament game this year with Conway. Salty Long is head coach, one of the best men on the planet. My son Evan plays. Salty knows him. Obviously, Evan took a hard hit, got knocked out of the game. After the game, I talked to Salty. Salty grabs Evan and gives him a hug because he has a relationship with him, just like Brad has a relationship with Evan. I think if you start seeing more of the genuine and not the forced, that's where it's going to grow. That's where you see the two players come together and say, you know, grab, you know, a 5 and a hug and talk about how they battled each other, because that's where the respect comes from. But when you force it, it loses the sense of, you know, it's not authentic. I'm forcing you to do this. So I think we get away from it, make it authentic. If that's the one thing COVID gives us, we'll take it. Yes. Let's get back to authentic sportsmanship, not a ritual.
Agreed, 100%. All right, let's wrap up quarter number 1.
The first quarter is in the books.
Let's move to quarter number 2. Our second question is, how do we help kids to deal with failure? So as coaches, what is our role and responsibility in helping kids navigate when they fail?
I think it all comes back to being honest and telling the kids the truth. I think the more we're truthful with them, that it makes everything easier. It makes success easier. It makes failure easier. We had players that we felt couldn't handle success. And meaning they would go out and have a great game, and then the next game they would come in, and not saying confidence is a bad thing, but they would come in with a false sense of confidence and struggle. Well, then all of a sudden now their body language is bad. And it was because it wasn't they couldn't handle the failures, and we never taught them how to handle success. And I think that's the key to help a kid with failure, is teaching them to handle success, explaining to them why they were successful. Sometimes you just got to be honest. You know why you were successful? Because you weren't on the scouting report the night before. You know why you're struggling now? Because you're on the scouting report. You know why you were successful? Because this team's not real good. You know, but you know why you're not successful now is because you're trying to get away with the same stuff. You know, I can't make the same pass against a 5'10 guard as I can against a 6'4 guard. So I think the key to failure is you got to teach them how to succeed and why they're succeeding and how to sustain success. You know, I mean, we're the world's worst. I'm on it. You're on it. Everybody's on it. I couldn't stand it this season when I would see it. And luckily, none of my players did this. But there were players that I would see, you know, tough loss. But I had 12 points. Well, no, I mean, like, come on. That's not teaching you how to handle failure. That's trying to put the you know, sunshine inside the thunderstorm. Like, your team lost. You know, we can't talk about that. But, like, it's one of those things that you can't, like, I can't teach you how to fail if I hadn't taught you how to succeed yet. And some of these guys, when they see failure, it becomes an excuse. It becomes a blame game. And it just comes back to, like we talked all the time, about being truthful. You got to tell players the truth, where they're at, where they stand, what they're good at, what they're bad at, how they can get better. And then they've got to accept it. And that's one of the keys to success, is the acceptance of it. You know, I'll use my son for an example. Hayden, my oldest son, he had more of a self-awareness than any player I've ever coached. And the problem with that is I didn't give him a chance to do that because I worried about outsiders watching me play him. I should have played him more. We both talked about that. Coaches have told me that. And not because he was such a great talent, but he had such self-awareness. My youngest son, Evan, has the same flaw, you know, has the same things that – he has such an awareness of himself. He doesn't find himself in trouble very much. You know, like, he doesn't find himself trying to accomplish more. And I think self-awareness is that key on failure too, is you got to know, if we're going to help kids avoid failure, which I don't think we need to help them avoid it. I think we have to teach them how to learn from it and how to use failure, not as a motivation, but as a learning lesson. Is they've got to be aware of the situation. And again, self-awareness comes from telling kids the truth. So,
and do you think process goes along with that? Because as I hear you talking, what comes into my mind is, you know, you mentioned, well, you can get away with this against a 5'10 kid, but you can't get away with it against a 6'4 kid. And ultimately, what you want kids to do is to be able to say, hey, if you play the game the right way, if you practice the right way, if you do some of the things that we talk about day in and day out as a part of our program, and you live up to those standards every day, you're going to end up having some success, and you're also going to have some failure, because at some point everybody fails regardless of how good your process is. But knowing that if you stick with that process and you're aware of where you are in the process, like you described, then ultimately you're going to end up having success. And that success can be defined differently, obviously, by different people. And it's not always defined by the scoreboard. You could play the number one ranked team in the state, and you may follow all your processes, and you may do everything, play as hard as you possibly can. You still may come up short on the scoreboard. Conversely, you could play the worst game of your life against a terrible team and win that game. And which one of those should you be happier with? The reality is you should be happier with the loss, where you played as hard as you possibly could and did all the things to put yourself in a position to win, than you should playing against a, you know, a crummy team. And I just think that that process piece of it goes right along with what you said, with the truth telling and with being self-aware. To me, all three of those pieces kind of work in harmony to help kids to understand how to deal with failure.
Yeah. And I think the coach's side of it, you know, what you were talking about right there, that's what we call resulting from, you know, my friend, Annie Duke wrote Thinking and Bets. She wrote the book, How to Decide. And too many coaches get caught up in the result. You know, did we win? Great. Did we play awful? Who cares? You know, and like most of the good coaches are, we're never going to complain about a win, never going to cry about a win, but we want to get better winning. And, you know, if people are looking for an off-season book, if they haven't read it yet, Annie has How to Decide. It saved my career, along with Thinking and Bets, but it this year, like above all years, in a year when COVID, when you have no clue what's coming. It teaches you how to make decisions. It teaches you how to plan things out. You know, I use the example, you know, talking and going back to failure, you know, when you ask somebody, if a kid shoots the ball, what's going to happen? Well, immediately most people think, well, he's going to make or miss. Okay. Well, that's a 50-50. Those are not really good odds in our business. We may want to think we're going into a game that's 50-50, but we hope we're going into a game and we have a 70-30 chance of winning. Sometimes we know going to a game, we got a 30% chance of winning. But what that does, what this book taught me and what it's taught others, and is what you just said, like it's a process of, well, a kid shoots the basketball. Well, he makes it. That's great. Well, what if he misses and we get the rebound? That's still good. What if he misses and gets fouled? That's really good. What if he makes it and gets fouled? That's really, really good. What if he misses it, the ball goes out of bounds off them, but we get the ball back? That's still good. What if he misses it, they get the rebound? That's the only bad thing that can happen. That's six things I've just mentioned, and only one of those is bad. So it's not a 50-50 on a shot, if you think of it in those terms. So a lot of people put their happiness, win or lose, failing, succeeding, on yes or no. It's a one or two option, and I've learned that it's never one or two options. Mike talks about this, you know, when he was first coaching and they were in high school, that if there's nights that if I can win one quarter, that's a success for this program. That was the point he was at those places. So teaching kids that success and failure isn't 50-50, but it can be, you know, five out of six are positive. That's a really good thing. So go ahead and take the shot, because five out of six things good are for us. And so I feel that's one of the keys, like you mentioned, with process, the explanation and the philosophy behind teaching kids how to deal with failure is what we're able to do as coaches. And that's going to make their lives better. It's going to make our teams better. But more importantly, it makes the individual better.
How much of it do you think, Greg, is you as a coach or as a coaching staff modeling what it's like to handle failure? Because I think that when I think about myself, whether it's as a player or I think of myself as a coach, I think one of the things that's difficult to do is to manage your emotions without regard to the scoreboard. And that's really, really tough to do, where maybe you played a great game and you played as hard as you could. You did everything, you executed to the best of your ability. And for whatever reason, you still came up short. And obviously, as competitors, we all want to win games. And so when we don't, how do we model for kids what that looks like? Because in theory, we failed in our mission to win on the scoreboard. And yet, in a lot of ways, we didn't fail if we followed our process. We did all the things that we want to do. So how do we make sure that we're modeling that that loss isn't a failure? Is there anything that you specifically do to just remind yourself that, hey, I've got to be a role model for kids in terms of how we react to losing a game on the scoreboard?
I think this year taught me more than anything, just going back to what we talked about with gratitude. One of the things that I adopted and adapted for our program from Mike Neighbors is this: I don't do a post-game talk. We all grew up, you know, if you got beat, you went in there and then you got beat down by your coach for 10 minutes. I don't, win or lose, I don't go in and talk long. 2 minutes max. Obviously, last game of the year is a little different when you're telling the seniors bye. You know, games we lost, we walked in, hey, we got to get better at this. Anybody hurt? Okay, let's get out of here. Now, here's one of the reasons we were so fast, too, and it worked this year. You know, we were all in that close contact warning. We were all afraid that I was going to get a call that player A tested positive and he was sitting beside player B, C, D, and E.
Yep.
So we cut down our talks. Because, and here's the thing too, they don't want to hear it. If you go on and read, we can talk about books you should be reading as coaches and all that, but this generation is so wired to quick information. They don't want to hear that stuff. You know, I mean, they don't need to hear it. And we've all been a coach before. After a win, you go in and you're high-fiving, jumping up and down, and player Jay sitting over here mad because he didn't get to play. You know, and so it was something that, you know, me and Mike talked a long time about. I didn't know if I could pull it off. I love it now. I'm out and I'm not in there 3 minutes. Go in. Hey, good job. Keep your heads up. Go in and say, hey, good job. Nice win. Here's where we're practicing. Is anybody hurt? You know, let's get to a trainer. Let's get that fixed. Get your stuff. Let's roll. And just knowing that they weren't, you know, it's okay to be upset when you get beat. But like you said, I was so gracious with every game we finished. That we wanted to win them all. We lost 13 times this year. I can go back and think of four of them off the top of my head that I'd love to play again. But the way we handled the defeats were, got to get better, got to move on. Got to get better, got to move on. Fix this, move on. And I think that changed. Now, I think I got three technicals this year. I got one going after an official because I thought a player got a technical I thought was uncalled for. I said some magic words. I got one. I got one later on in the year because I thought a guy flopped on a 3-point call. I yelled across the floor of the official and I took 2 steps down the court, got whacked. That's fine. I think I maybe only two. I don't know if I got a third one. If I did, it doesn't stand out to me. But just explain the players too how we got to react to situations. This year, more than anything, my big word for myself and our program was react, because there are so many times that we could have reacted maybe how we wanted to, but not the way we should, from a professional standpoint, from a leadership standpoint, and from a profile standpoint. And so I think react was the main word for us this year. Learn how to react. That's who you are. Your reactions are who you are. You know, we've all seen it. I've seen coaches go. I watched them either in film, on in person, whatever, and they just belittle an official and players, and then they want to, you know, first next thing they're on Twitter posting a prayer, you know, of scripture, or they're in, and I'm like, I get that, but like it's all got to mirror each other, you know. And so I think that that's the big thing, is just how you react to things is who you are. That's who you really are. It's how you react. And we try to teach our guys and ourselves too, to how to control our reactions. And that was tough. I know stress this year was high for everyone. There was a lot of uncertainty at all times. But I felt, you know, going back again to cleaning up on how you teach those, it's your reaction is who you are. And that's what we try to make sure people saw out of our staff and out of our players, is how we reacted to things, whether they were good or bad. And that's who we truly are.
And I think to go along with that, I think players can sniff out a fraud. And if you're reacting one way and then you come back in and you preach something else in a moment where you're not reacting to something that might be a situation that is adverse, players are going to be like, okay, you can tell me this all you want, but I just watched you during the game do X, Y, and Z, or say X, Y, and Z to me in a situation where, if you were following the words that you're telling me now during this moment of calm, this wouldn't have happened. And so I think players can sniff that out. And to me, when you're talking about helping kids to deal with failure, you're talking about what we said here. You're talking about being able to tell players the truth. You're talking about making sure that you are reacting in such a way that it reflects who you truly are. And when you do those things, I think ultimately you're going to be able to help players deal with success. And with that, we will wrap up the second quarter and we will move to the halftime break.
That was the halftime buzzer. Let's take a quick break.
Hey, hoopheads, we all hate ankle sprains and they happen way too often. Ankle injuries are the number one sports-related injury. Arise is trying to change that. With the iFast, your athletes get preventative protection and full mobility. Athletes no longer need to wear bulky braces that limit performance and give mediocre protection. Anyone playing sports should be using these products. Keep your athletes in the game. Don't wait for them to get hurt to take action. Visit www.arise.com/teampricing to learn more. That's ARYSE.com. And it is now time for our third quarter. And I think this is going to be an interesting discussion, because the question is there an overemphasis on the three-pointer, especially in the high school game? And Greg, I know you have a strong feeling about this on one side, and I may end up just trying to play devil's advocate on the other side. So go ahead and give us your position on the importance of the three-pointer and where we are in terms of utilizing it in the game today.
So I'm a big proponent of the three. And my reasons are always based off, you know, what I have, what you have. You know, we all heard, again, I'm going to tie in thinking and bets from Annie Duke on this. We've all heard it's a game of chess, and it's not a game of chess. If it was a game of chess, we would all have the same players, the same pieces with the same abilities. And so the 3-point shot has become the equalizer. It gives you a chance. It gives, you know, use a boxing term, it gives you a slugger's chance. You know, the way I played this season gave us a chance in every ball game. Doesn't mean we won every game, but we had a chance to win because of the style we played. So we played 31 games. I wish I could say 1,000, but I can't, because I don't want to lie to you. We took 999 threes this year. We made 300 of them. Now, had we made 305, 310, our record changes, obviously. So we averaged 9 made threes a game. We had games that we made 17 out of 31. We had games that we made 4 out of 31. And what I had to finally explain to our players was we're playing the math. We're not, you know, if we came out and we obviously we play 17, we make 17 threes, we win that ball game. And then the very next game, we went 4 of 30. We still won, but our kids were down in the locker room because, man, we played bad. We shot bad. We didn't shoot bad. We shot the number. We shot the average. I mean, if you take the two games and combine them, we shot our season average. And so it kind of taught our kids to play free, to play, to enjoy the game. I think it was frustrating for people to watch that didn't understand it. I had coaching friends of mine that watched us play early in the year, and they're like, you know, they were down on me. They're like, oh, he doesn't care. He doesn't care how they're playing. He's giving up. And then by the time we got to the state tournament, they were like, this is how you have to play. I was like, we figured that out. Our staff figured it out. This is how we have to play. One of the reasons I love the three, obviously, it's a 50% increase from 1 foot. From one step back, it's a 50% increase. We don't teach shot fake, pull-up, mid-range pull-up jumper. We teach shot fake sidestep three because we want to keep the same point value. We have guys that can shoot off the dribble off the three, meaning they can come down a fast break and stop and shoot a three versus going in for a layup. And a lot of that, we talk about philosophy. You're teaching your player, hopefully, to pick the ball up, to stop the ball. A lot of times in a two-on-one situation, we've all been in those two-on-one drills. Where do we tell them? Well, we tell them to go to the rim and wait to make a decision. So you go ahead and go to the rim, you're going to block out because we're shooting it. And so we kind of made up, we follow the make you wrong for being right. You know, whatever you're teaching on defense, we teach anti on offense. And taking a lot of threes was one of the things that we did. Surprisingly, the teams that gave us the most trouble played us a 2-3 zone. Knowing that we would shoot a lot of threes, the teams that played us a zone gave us the most trouble. And I think it was because our kids here, you got to shoot them out of a zone. And so we put more pressure on ourselves to make shots. But that was one of the problems that we faced was we struggled in that spot with if you went in the zone, it kind of messed with us a little bit. So I think it's a great thing for high school basketball. I think it's a great thing for college basketball. If you watch teams that are making more threes or winning the games, that was kind of how we told our kids. We never felt that we thankfully got to play the shot clock this year in Arkansas. And so we never felt we were out of a game. Our style allowed us to win games. Again, it allowed us to lose some games that we shouldn't have. I say that people say we shouldn't have on paper. Everybody we scheduled this year was good enough to beat us. And so I am totally for it. I think it's a key. I think it increases your scoring, increases your skill level. We didn't have as many charges. If you're watching college basketball right now, we've talked about this. If they would change the mechanic from Mike Tyson's punch out to making a heart sign or a halo, they'd quit calling charges, but they like being able to do the punch out.
Yep.
But when you're shooting threes, you're not getting a lot of charges called.
Dude, you just got Mike with a Mike Tyson punch out. I don't know if he knows that reference. Mike, do you know that reference?
I do know that. Absolutely.
Listen.
I mean, I'm not a video game guy, but I'm aware of Mike Tyson punch out. So
okay, well,
I got that one. That one I got.
Okay, I just want to make sure because Mike did his patented laugh after pretending like he knew what you were talking about.
No,
so I didn't know.
I did know that. I do have a patented laugh on the ones I don't know, but that was one I did know.
Okay,
but
good.
That,
I'm glad.
But I'm telling you, I mean, it's if you research it and look at it, I think it's. I think shooting the three is. I mean, there's been very few people change the game of basketball. Wilt Chamberlain, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Michael Jordan, Seth Curry changed basketball. And so if you watch our film, not only do we shoot a lot of threes, we try to shoot 22, 23 feet and out. I love the NBA. I love their spacing. And everybody says, oh, well, you can't play the NBA. And you can't play like the NBA plays in high school because there's no illegal defense. There isn't. You're right. But if my guy's shooting from 23 feet, you're going to have to come out and guard him. And so that opens up the floor more. And that creates longer closeouts, and that creates more driving opportunities. And so the three has changed the game. You know, what it's funny now is the hot thing was when you say, of course, you know, Dirk Nowitzki, those guys ruined basketball because they were 7-footers that could shoot threes. Now everybody wants to be a 7-footer that can shoot threes. You know how impressive a true post player is, like right now, like they're like a unicorn, you know.
Absolutely.
Like when a guy says, "Oh, he's 7 foot, can step out," big deal. I want a 7-footer that can drop step and shoot a jump hook. You know, I mean, we all fell in love watching Luka Garza this year for Iowa, and now Krutwig at Loyola Chicago might be the most valuable player in the tournament because he can score at the block. And so until you have those, I mean, I can teach any player from 5'4" to 7'2" to shoot a three. I can't teach a lot of guys to be post players. And so the three has got to become universal and something that we all can do. And I think it's a main weapon. And I think it's here to stay for sure. I mean, I think it's just going to keep increasing. You know, like I said, we shot 999 this year. I kind of wish I was, that's around 30 a game. I was wanting to be in the 35 to 40, but that matched our makeup. Like our biggest player was 6'4" this year. The team that just won our state tournament has a 7-footer. I don't have those. So we're not all playing chess, you know, and so I've got to do what I've got to do. And I believe that's what every coach should be doing, is what's best for you and what's best for us was shoot 1,000 threes this year. So.
All right, so I want to just throw two scenarios at you to just get your thoughts and your takes on them. The one is happened a couple weeks ago, and this is sort of as an old school guy, when it's a 3-on-1 and you had the Denver Nuggets where they're coming down, they need a 2-pointer. I think they needed a 2-pointer to win the game. I think they were down 1, and I know Michael Porter was one of the guys that instead of just going to the basket for what would have been pretty much 100% certain layup or dunk, instead guys are flaring out behind the 3-point line. And that's something that me, as again, an old guy who hasn't played in the game the way it's being played today, it still seems to me that if it's a 3-on-1, that a 2-point layup in that case is more valuable than the attempted 3. And I get the math over the long portion of the game. But whenever I see guys fanning out to the 3 on a 3-on-1 break, I always cringe a little bit. So what's your take? How do you approach that with your team? Or is that something that happens so rarely that it's not even really worth teaching or preparing for, if that makes any sense?
No, and I get what you're saying. I mean, we talk about trying to get the bet, you know, we want to score. But for us, we would be fine with that 3 because it's probably the most open 3 we're going to get. You know, the scouting report on us was you had to run them off the line. I mean, even our player that played our 5, who was 6'3½, 6'4", maybe 200 pounds, he made threes. And so, we tell kids on tryouts, if you can't shoot, you can't play here. Like, we want to be the best shooting team in the state of Arkansas. And that's kind of what we push for because that's something we can control. I can't control how big the players are that move into my district. I can control how good of a shooting team we are. And so I'm with you. 3-on-1 would have been, you know, we're probably going to have one guy going to the rim if he chooses. If he stops and shoots a 3, you know, we're fine with that. And if it's the right person, if it's not, people know where to go. People are going to run. But we're probably going to take a 3 there too because, I mean, you're thinking sure too. I'm thinking attempt at 3. Again, going back to how to decide, in my mind, I'm thinking I take a shot at a 3. I got 2 rebounders versus 1 rebounder. I'm going to get a 2 eventually. Or I might even get a rebound kick out another 3, which is the easiest 3 to make. So you're thinking 2 points. I'm thinking 3 points. But I'm also thinking 2 attempts. And so that just kind of changes. You know, I don't ever want to be a prisoner of analytics. I just finished a book called The Data Detective, where it teaches you how to look at numbers and what to believe, what not to believe, how to use it for yourself. You know, we can all, Coaches will tell you, they're going numbers tell you what you want them to tell you. But I think that the game is changing so much that you don't get very many clean options at a three. That's one of the best times to take it. It's on a fast break because it is a clean chance. So
makes sense. I get it. It's just every time I see it, just from my own experiences, I still just, look at it. I'm like, oh, it's gotta be a layup. I don't understand. And yet you see so many teams doing it repeatedly over and over and over and over again. And I think it's just one of those things that I don't know if I'll ever get used to it, but I guess I've come to understand it, if that makes sense.
So think about how we were taught. I haven't done a three-man weave in probably 10 years because I started thinking about how many times have I ever passed and got behind a guy. Now, I'll do it. Now, we'd run some half-court sets, and we do it in a shooting drill where we do what we call pitches, and we dribble and pitch, and that. But we don't do that. I stopped doing an 11-man fast break, which is a 3-on-2 fast break that a lot of people did. One of the reasons we stopped working on it, we went to a progressive fast break, which is it's controlled, but it's not predictable. Is, you know, you think about the 3-on-2 fast breaks we were always taught with the two defenders stacked, one at the nail, one at the rim. Ball's pass to the wing. You know, the bottom guy had first pass. So that's how we were taught. Bottom guy has first pass, top guy's going to drop. You were giving up a shot every time doing that. You're either going to give up an elbow jump shot or a lob for a layup. So last time we did it, we switched it where the bottom guy, you just stay put. And so I'm guarding the ball. They pass it. I'm going to run to guard him. I'm not giving up a layup. Well, now I've changed how you're thinking on offense. And so, you know, we just started wanting to be ahead of the curve and thinking, watching a lot of European stuff. And for whatever reason, they're ahead of us. I mean, I don't know why. Like, you know, we obviously have better athletes. We're USA teams, you know, dominated. But the coaching in Europe has been amazing to follow. Some guys I've become friends with and pick their brain constantly. And it just came to – you know, going back on our topic, what gave us a chance was being a 3-point shooting team. And, you know, there were nights that we knew, you know, again, we came out, we had games of seven, we made 17, 16, 13, 12. We had a game, we made four. We've been here. We opened the school up 5 years ago. We've had 141 games. We've made a 3-point shot in at least 140 of them. We've only had one game. We didn't make a three. In that game, we went 0-for-8, and we won by 35. but you know, it's like, and I just know that because I looked it up, and the player that went 0-for-5, I always reminded that he broke the streak. You know, we would be perfect. But that was one of those things that when we all hear control what you can control, I can control how good of a shooting team we are. Can't control how big we are. Can't really control how good a defensive team we are because the way sometimes I want to defend, the officials won't let me. But I can control how good of a shooting team we are by the amount of time we spend shooting in the off season, in the season. So that's my take on a 3-point shot. I think it's the best weapon you have.
All right, I got one more thing to throw at you.
Okay.
Something else that I see a lot of, and you see it at the collegiate level, and I see it a lot at the high school level, where a team is running. Could be maybe a 4-out, 1-in, could be a 5-out. And what I see it devolve into is one player has the ball at the 3-point line. They make a move to go 1-on-1. Maybe they penetrate. The other 4 or 3 guys on the perimeter are stagnant. And then that player who drives in kicks it to the next guy. And if he doesn't have a shot, then he gets his turn to go play 1-on-1. And if he doesn't have a shot, then he kicks it to the next guy. And there's very little imagination or movement off ball to create better opportunities. And I think when you see better teams play that are better coached, you see that you still have that dribble drive. You still have the penetration, but you have the other players on the floor doing more than just standing and watching. And I think that's something that I see too often where a 4-out, 1-in or a 5-out just becomes players taking turns 1-on-1 and trying to kick out to somebody for a 3. Do you see that a little bit in Arkansas? Do you see that when you watch games? And what's your take on how do you combat that if I'm running like a 4-out, 1-in offense?
So we played 5-out this year. We played a little bit of 4-out, 1-in. And it does happen. one of the hardest things to do on offense is stand. And we have to tell our guys that. Quit creeping up to the ball. Stay where you're at. Stand there. Because if I stand, my defender stands. And now we try to always have action away from the ball. But again, they stand, they watch, you know. Here's the thing, too. If I'm moving, it's hard for me to know I'm going to get a shot. And we want our guys thinking catch and shoot and catching plays, what we would tell them. So we would try to run action that would create a bigger gap and try to create help spots, you know, make you wrong for being right. We want you to help on defense. We could score. But yeah, sometimes we were okay with it. There were times I would complain about how stagnant we were, but we were scoring, you know, 68 points a game, 70 points a game because we work on catch and shoot a lot. We work on penetrate, get your feet wet in the paint and pass, kick drives and kicks. And sometimes that requires standing. And we would tell our guys, if we put you in the right spot and you stand, it's okay. If you find yourself in one of these spots, you need to move. We want them to stand in the corner. You know, we don't want you to stand at the top of the key. We don't want you to stand the 45. We want you to clear the nail defender and move somewhere. But those were all things that, I mean, we battle, you know, for whatever reason with the emergence of skill guys and individual training, the dribble, you know, became a big thing. You know, let's dribble through 95 cones and that, you know, that's kind of caused some of that. But we talk about just attacking either with a shot or, you know, attack to create for your teammate. And so that's one of the downfalls of shooting so many threes. There is a lot of standing, but there's also the fact that, I mean, those are the ones you're going to make are the standstill threes. And so it's kind of that, I think we're going to be better about it next year because we spent this year really working on, I think, way better at creating more of that movement that you're talking about. But again, it's kind of the nature of the beast. If you're going to rely on the three, you're going to be prepared to shoot the three. So,
yeah. And as you said, I think it is a good point that the best highest percentage shot, especially when you're talking about the high school level, is a kid who's going to catch and shoot and is already in position where they're getting their feet underneath them. They're prepared to shoot. It's not somebody who's, you know, coming off a pin down screen and squaring up in the air in motion and trying to get the shot off a defender that's chasing at them. You're trying to create easier looks for your teammates. And it always strikes me though, when I see teams playing that way, that I'm always like, man, if they could just get a little bit of movement on the weak side to be able to not allow that defense to just be stagnant and be in the lane ready to help, I think they could generate so much more out of it. And of course, now there's such an emphasis with the ball screen. So you have, especially if you're running a four out, one in, you saw it like when Ohio State played Illinois in the Big Ten championship game. And those two teams just, you know, the big man just stepped out from the block and set a screen to try to get the guard an advantage. And then that guard gets a little advantage and now you got to help and boom, now you're kicking out for threes. And it was just kind of amazing to watch both teams kind of doing the same thing over and over and over again and still creating good looks from it, because it's just the screen roll. It's why the screen roll has become such an important part of the game, because it's so difficult to defend and it just creates such an advantage for the offense. And all you need when you have good skilled players is you get the guy who's the ball handler with a little bit of an advantage, and that guy can now create maybe the first advantage, doesn't create the shot, but then the second guy has a little bit easier time penetrating. And then before you know it, you created the ability to bounce the ball around the perimeter and create the shot that you want. And in all likelihood, it's probably going to be a three.
Right. And, you know, and again, that's like, I mean, as much as basketball is evolving and stuff, it's still the same. You know, I mean, there's so much stuff that still looks the same, still is the same. But for us, and I think a lot of teams, that it's that swingers, you know, it gives me a puncher's chance. I think it gives everybody that. And you're watching these games coming up this next weekend, you know, it's going to come down to guys that can make shots, because the game's so physical inside now. And I think it's the equalizer. It gives everybody a chance.
Absolutely. All right. That is the end of quarter number three. Hey, coaches, parents, and group leaders. I want to introduce you to our newest sponsor, SnapRaise. SnapRaise is the nation's largest digital donation platform built to help teams, youth groups, and clubs raise money quickly and efficiently without selling products. SnapRaise builds your group a customizable campaign website, and students use their mobile devices to connect and engage with their biggest fans. My son's high school team used SnapRaise this season, and our team raised all the money they needed to fund their season and then some. Getting SnapRaise started is quick and free. Just visit snapraise.com and you'll get connected to a local SnapRaise expert in no time.
All right, listeners, it's time for the fourth quarter.
It is time for the fourth quarter. And our last question is, the extra year of eligibility that the NCAA has granted basketball players for next season, what is going to be the impact on you as a high school coach and high school players as they look to transition into their freshman year of college next season?
The first thing I'll say is I think they got it wrong. I think it should have been given to the players in the NCAA tournament last year that got there. I think they should have went ahead and had the selection show for the men and the women, and then granted those players a chance to come back. That's who lost out. I know the players this year played under, you know, distress, a lot of no fans, couldn't go home to see their family. I know it's tough on them, but I think we messed up by not letting those people come back. My other idea was have those teams selected. If those teams didn't get in this year, they were in this year. Make it a 128-team tournament for 1 year. You know, I mean, we took away, and I don't want to get into all that stuff, but we took away a lot of chance for people. And now it's just it's, you know, kind of a snowball effect. It's just rolling downhill because we're giving players a year back, and a lot of those players aren't going to stay where they were at. I think if you're going to use the COVID year, you should use it at the university that just paid for your education for a year. I think that's where you should spend it. But, you know, as those players are going to transfer, I think the number was 800 today in the men's transfer portal. You know, if you're a high school senior and have an offer, you better take it because that's who's going to suffer. The high school senior, the JUCO player looking to move, those are the ones that are going to miss out because, you know, as the transfer model becomes more and more, I think you'll see less mid-major Division I's offering high school kids. I think you'll see the mid-majors are going after D2s and Power 5 transfers that transfer down because they're not happy with their minutes. It's going to open up that Pandora's box of how do we ever get control of it again. And I don't know what the answer is, but that it's really affecting the high school recruiting for sure. I mean, I you don't hear as many, you know, first of all, there's no McDonald's All-American game. There's none of those games going. They're still doing the award, but outside of the schools that had already made their recruiting, like you didn't hear very many people from the 2021 class getting offers. A lot of them are going to reclassify, which I don't even understand that. And go, you know, to a prep school or a post-grad school. State of Kentucky, you said give high school players a year back. Well, what are you going to do with them? You know, I mean, are you going to what are they going to do for class? You know,
they're going to sleep in until 2 o'clock and then go to practice. That's what they're going to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's just it's an unfortunate thing. You know, I love the state of Arkansas, born and raised here for so many reasons. The fact that we played a full football season. We just played a full basketball season, baseball, softball, track, soccer going. You know, our governor is a hooper. I mean, he's played basketball at our gym. His grandsons are great players. He loves the game of basketball. He loves our state, loves our students. He gave us a chance. And that's all I think we all wanted. I mean, you guys talk to people across the country. I do too. There were guys that didn't get a chance to play. And I hate that because I worry about the mental aspect that it has on the student athletes. And, you know, so many people were, if missing a basketball season is bad for their mental health, I feel bad for the kid. Well, and we all know that there's kids that go to school because of basketball. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, and so I don't know what this year is going to do. I'm happy that some of those players get a year back. I talked with a friend of mine that's an NBA scout and we talked about some of the players that aren't performing. Is it because they know they got a free year? You know, some of the people that you thought were going to be big time college players this year that didn't have the numbers or didn't have the years because they know that this year doesn't count? Do they know they're coming back? When's the last time, I don't know if it's been in our lifetime, that Duke, Kentucky, Kansas aren't really the cream of the crop? You know, there's things going on that really didn't make sense to a lot of us. And, you know, again, I know COVID was crazy. I know it was real. But that the giving the full year back and it not being that same university, that kind of bugs me a little bit. But I hate it. You know, I hate it for the kids last year. We had high school seniors that had their track season pulled from them. Baseball, softball, didn't get to play. NCAA tournament, not getting to happen last year. You know, those are the kids I think deserved a redo, not people that got to play this year. And, you know, and all right, I mean, we could get all into the political climate of our country and everybody talk, how everybody feels different places. You know, I would talk to friends in California, man, we don't know if we're going to get to play. And I'm like, we've been practicing and playing like crazy, you know, and I hate that because I think we allowed, I know COVID was real. But I think we allowed our political mind to get involved in it so much that we took away opportunities from young people. And you know, granted, the NCAA has given some of that back, but I think the ones that we hurt the most are the ones that had it completely ripped from them.
Yeah, and I agree with you there. I couldn't agree more with that. You know, the kids that here in the state of Ohio, spring sports were wiped out last year. So if I'm a baseball player, I'm a track athlete, and I've prepared my whole life for my senior year, and now that's gone and that's taken away. That hurts. I mean, that, because we talk about it all the time. You don't get those back. And when you don't get it back, that's tough. Those kids are going to carry that with them for their entire life that they didn't get an opportunity to play. Whereas you think about this year, NCAA athletes, maybe they played a shortened schedule. Maybe there was things that were difficult and challenging, and there certainly were, but the vast majority of NCAA basketball players this year got to play some type of a season. And yeah, maybe it wasn't what they all hoped and wished that it would be, but they did get to play. And so I think you're right in the standpoint of last year's spring, anybody that was impacted there, that was probably the group that really and truly deserved to have that extra year. And I do think that when you talk about all the players in the transfer portal and you talk about how that impact of the transfer rules and players not having to sit out as they go from one school to another. And I get that you're trying to balance the playing field because the argument always is, well, coaches can leave anytime they want and they go to their next school and then they're ready to coach right away. Meanwhile, the kids that they left behind, if they want to go to a new program, they got to sit out. So I get all the rules, but I had a coach tell me, a college coach say to me that he foresees a time where college coaches don't even recruit high school players anymore. He goes, there's going to be programs that they're not even going to look at high school players anymore because they're going to go and they're going to look at either players above or below their level that have already proven themselves in the college level. So why would I go and recruit a high school player when I can recruit a guy who's already proven himself in high school? And you're going to have a lot of kids that go in as a freshman and they say, hey, I just averaged 13 points a game at a mid-major Division I school, I bet I can go and play in a Power 5 conference now. And there's going to be a lot of Power 5 conference coaches that agree with them. They're going to take those players. And I think it's going to be really hard to build a mid-major powerhouse program because the good kids that normally you would kind of find as diamonds in the rough, under-the-radar kids, and then you bring them in and you develop them over the course of 4 years. And by the time they're seniors and they're experienced and they've played together and now you're ready to make a Cinderella run in the tournament. I think that's going to be harder and harder to do because those really good players are going to leave to go be the seventh or eighth man, maybe on a Power 5 conference school.
So it is March 24th, 2021. I'm going to make a prediction. In the next 25 years, you'll see the end of high school sports. I think what you'll have is more of a European model to where you'll have the NBA teams, you'll have a G League team, and then you'll have club teams. where they basically take over AAU. Because AAU is broke, we know that. It became a moneymaker and became less of a talent creator. And so what you'll see is you'll see major markets that'll start, and then you'll start seeing some satellite clubs. And so there'll be no more high school athletics. High school football will survive. High school basketball will go away. You'll have kids that play on clubs. Everything else will be recreational. NCAA will be, if you're actually going for a degree, that it won't be the big moneymaker that it is now, because it'll become a direct competitor with the NBA. The NBA's G League and U18s, like FIBA, will become the major markets. I think COVID, that's one thing COVID did to hurt high school athletics, is so many states. We've heard people talk here. I mean, we had a surplus this year in travel. Why? Well, we didn't have spring sports. And so someone that wasn't an athlete that doesn't have kids that are athletes is thinking, do we really need them? Because we just went a year without them. Had they shut down football in the South, basketball, I think it would have happened within 10 years that you would see high school athletics go away, because we've all found out that you can still be educated over a screen. We've all found out that there's things that can happen. And I think this transfer portal, I think that the extra year, I think COVID, I think all this, there's someone out there that thinks a lot more crazier than I do, that's actually has the backing for it, that this will be a direction you see it, that it'll become more, that basketball will become a club entity, that it'll, you know, kids in Arkansas may play for the Grizzly 16U, or the Oklahoma City Thunder 16U, you know, and that's where it becomes, we put you in these clubs and we try to funnel our way up through our G League team. And then now you become a pro and you play on our pro team. If you don't play any of those, that's great. Go get a degree, because you're going to be a banker, but you can still play basketball for University of Arkansas. It's just not going to be on the level that the top five players, you know, the top 55 players in the country every year are probably not going to start be playing college basketball. They're going to go, you know, to their pro level. And that may not be a bad thing. Maybe that cleans up college basketball. Maybe that changes things, that, you know, you let the top 50 kids go turn pro and start making money. But, you know, always the downfall is what are they going to do after basketball? And so I worry that we've made changes too radical this year. I mean, I'm glad that NCAA is giving some kids a year back. I think they gave the wrong ones. I think it should have been the spring sports. I think it should have been the players that qualified for, you know, the NCAA tournament. You know, the argument there was, well, why wouldn't everybody? Well, everybody's season didn't get ended last year. You know, you should have had the selection Sunday. Those 68 men teams, 64 women's team, that's who you guys get to all come back. And then the argument would have been, well, now you've made it unfair. We did for a year. We made it unfair for a year. We gave those 64 women's team and those 68 men's team, we gave them what they had taken away from them. And guess what? They're going to graduate the next year. It's going to be over. But now what we've done is we've impacted an entire graduating class of high school seniors by log jamming in front of them. There's nowhere for them to go. And because there's nowhere for them to go this year, it's going to impact the 2022 class. It's going to impact the 2023 class, because we're going to set that model of, why do I want to recruit an 18-year-old kid when I can go get a 21-year-old transfer student that's already been there and played against competition? So I think it's going to change the landscape.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting. I love the point you made about the academies. I heard an interview with Mark Cuban, and I can't remember, it was probably about a year ago, and he talked about that exact system that you talked about, where NBA teams are at the top of that hierarchy, and then you go down to the G League, and then you have their basketball academies that are modeled after that European-style club, where you have multiple age groups and multiple teams and multiple levels, and you have professional coaches that are working with those kids, and obviously you can still have them in school, and they're going to school, but the primary focus of what they're doing outside of their daily educational curriculum is focused on basketball. And they have professional coaches who are there just to coach basketball. They're not there teaching social studies during the day. They're working on basketball skills. And I do think that at some point the NBA has they have a definitive interest in making that a reality, because it provides them with that farm system that basketball really has truly never had besides the college game. And it's another way for them to be able to generate revenue and control their product. And as you've said numerous times, and we've had this discussion on a bunch of fourth quarters, the AAU system currently as it's constituted. See, Jason, I did it again. Constituted. So I did that last night too, Greg. I said the word constituted for some reason instead of constituted.
Mike's creating his own words.
I think I just might have to go with constituted and just make that a word, and that will make me sound smarter. Anyway, I just think that the NBA eventually is going to get that done and is going to make it happen. And what the time frame is, I'm not sure. But you look at this year, two of the top five projected NBA draft picks are playing in the G League right now. And I think that number is only going to increase, especially if those guys do end up getting drafted in the top five and then they end up ultimately having success in the league. Once you get a couple of pioneers to kind of take that leap, it's going to be a lot easier to convince the next round of guys that, look, why do you want to go sit in class and be responsible for all that when you can just go and play basketball and get paid to do it? And it's going to become a compelling argument for a lot of players who are at that level when they start having the choice between going to play college basketball, which, as much as college basketball, and I'm loving watching the tournament this year, but college basketball is not the same as it was 20 or 30 years ago. The quality of the players isn't there. The familiarity with the teams isn't there. It's just not the same. The tournament itself is a spectacle, but the teams and the familiarity that people have with the players isn't the same. And I think players are going to eventually look at that. High school kids are going to say, why do I want to go and play college basketball when I can just go right to the G League? And to your point, if what we're talking about comes to fruition, they may make that decision when they're 11, as opposed to waiting until they're 18 to make that decision.
Right. And there's some good and there's some bad to it. You know, I mean, if I could change anything, you know, we were lucky enough to get a shot clock pass in Arkansas. If I could change anything, we would all play with the NCAA women's rules. They're by far the best. 20-minute halves in NCAA men, it's archaic. I mean, nope. What happens if they pick up their seventh foul with 14 minutes in the first half? I'm not watching that. You know, like, we're a fan-based entertainment. Yes, it's basketball, and yes, we want – but in the end, it's about fans and entertainment. That's why the NBA isn't entertaining, because it's a 24-second shot clock. It's, you know, it's an entertainment thing. But they're also – they're finding out – you know, in 2019, the top four individual NBA awards were foreign-born players. We've got the best athletes. We don't have the best players. And Mark Cuban's ahead of that. He knows that. Coach Showalter's on that. You know, that's why there's been such a push on the skill training and more time. I just think we're going to see a major change in the landscape of high school basketball, and I think a lot of it's pushed by, you know, what's going to happen this year. With the seniors getting that year back, it totally makes sense to me in a sport. Why would I take an 18-year-old when I can have one? You know, and it's not every level. And that's where one of the confusions, and I'm bad about it, I think we all are, is when you think college, everybody thinks what you see on television, Division I, Division IIIs, Division IIs, NAIs, they're all going to do it right. And keep doing it because it's an education-based thing. Division One has gotten to where it's athlete-student, not student-athlete. You know, it's really kind of changed some of that on the men's side. You know, I'm a big fan of women's basketball. I think they continue to do it right and change and trailblaze with rules. But it's just, I don't know. There's something's going to come from this that we'll see a lot of change. And I think – you know, the schools that are ahead in recruiting this year won't affect them. The schools that were behind, you'll see them kind of in the panic mode. But definitely we're going to see a change in how transfers are going to be taken ahead of high school seniors and just kind of, I guess, I wouldn't say anxious. I'm just kind of going to sit back and watch and see what it looks like.
To your point, I think that the entire basketball landscape, when we look back on this, whether it's 10 years from now or 25 years from now, I do think that there's going to be major changes in the system, and hopefully those changes end up being for the betterment of the game. There's obviously going to be downsides to whatever system ends up being put in place, but we kind of know the devil is in the details right now with the way that the system is set up, and there's issues and there's problems and there's things that I think detract from the quality of the game, the quality of the product that we're able to put out on the floor, and how we're developing our players. And you've said it a couple times that European players are developed in a different way, and I think they're more fundamentally sound. We have better athletes, which, again, we have a bigger pool of those athletes to dive into, to be able to extract the players to play at the highest level. So because our pool of talent is bigger, it doesn't necessarily show up that the lack of fundamentals across the board. But I think if we could take care of that lack of fundamentals and figure out a better system for teaching the game at the younger levels, I think we'd ultimately end up with a better product.
No, I agree with that. And, you know, and there's, and I mean, you guys know this, the beautiful thing about basketball is when it's played at a really high level, I mean, it's so much fun to watch, whether it's men or women. The cool thing about basketball is there's a kid in my PE class that doesn't want to play on a high school team. Doesn't want to, but he just wants to go and shoot hoops. That's great too. There's got to be, there's a place for that. The problem we ran into was the accessibility of basketball is where we found our summers became just, you know, polluted is the word I want to use. You know, it used to be when we were growing up, if you played on a summer team and you were good, like you had to work to get on that
team. No doubt.
Now you can play on six different summer teams because it's all pay to play. And that's where the greeds come involved. And I don't know if you guys saw Kendrick Perkins on Twitter.
Yeah, that was great. I mean, that was great. That was great.
When an NBA guy says it, you know, it's bad enough when it's a, I mean,
come on, Greg, you don't think, Greg, you don't think it's okay for fans to just go fighting in the middle of the AAU tournament? Come on, Greg. Where's your sense of hospitality? Come on.
When it was a high school coach from Arkansas complaining about it, you just don't like AAU. Man, I love AAU. I love good summer basketball. The Peach Jam is one of the top events in our country, but it's not all the Peach Jam. And that's what we've tried to tell people is like, don't go play in a back gym somewhere on a Saturday just because you think that's not AAU basketball. That's just pay to play. Go play in a park. And when finally an NBA, you know, vet comes out and says, look, this is wrong. You know, maybe now it'll wake some people up, but that we'll save that for episode 8.
I think we've just thrown everybody into that same pool. And the kid that you described in your PE class that just wants to shoot around is almost forced to play in the same environment as the kid who is a high school varsity starter. And you throw all those kids into the same mix because recreation basketball, for lack of a better way of saying it, has gone away or been devalued or been looked upon as, you know, you don't want to go do that. And then the opportunity to play pickup basketball in a lot of places has been taken away simply because courts aren't there or people have taken down nets or gyms are closed, whatever it might be. And I just think that there has to be a better way of tiering the system so that the kid who just wants to play for fun has a place to play. And the kids who want to take the game more seriously have a place to play. And I think problems come when you cross mingle those two and you're not sure what your objective is when you're a parent or you're a player and you're getting involved in these various things. And then we could do a whole nother podcast on the, I don't even know what you call it, the unrealistic expectations of parents when it comes to their own child's basketball ability and teams and then fighting and taking things way too seriously. It gets ridiculous. So I think that's a good place to end it. And that will be the end of the fourth quarter.
That's game, man.
Greg, as always, we cannot thank you enough for taking the time to jump on.
Hey, I want to note, we literally went like exactly how long a game is, an hour and 20 minutes, a high school basketball game. What do you think?
That's about right.
That's about right, right?
That's about right. So we're in good shape. We did pretty well. We did pretty well. And that was fun. I think we covered a lot of great things for coaches out there to listen and be able to think about. And I always, whenever we have a conversation, it always leaves me with things to think about and consider And hopefully for our coaches that are out there in the audience, you feel the same way. So Greg, again, thanks. Appreciate it. Let people know where they can reach out to you, find you, and then I'll jump back in and wrap up this four quarters, number seven.
Yeah. So easiest way to get me is on Twitter at GregWhite32. You can, my cell phone, my email, everything is on there. If you shoot me a direct message and we'll talk, I'll answer those. We'll try to connect, you know, get a call, something set up together. I have a website, 3fromthecorner.com. I usually just talk about, you know, basketball stuff on there, whether it's being a dad, coach, you know, things that pop up, things like that. So, hey, I do want to give a quick little awesome, like, this guy has become my hero this week. Paul Heupler from Abilene Christian. If you guys watch their game, he was the guy, what they were calling the big energy guy on the bench. I talked about, you know, CBS Sports said, you know, 0 minutes played, bench hype infinity. And those are the guys. Yep. Like, I had a tweet out 3 days ago. You know, I talked about 4 years of showing up every day to practice, 4 years of making his team better, and teams that win big games win because of guys like this. You know, not everybody's a leading scorer, but everybody can be a great teammate. And, you know, Paul was a great teammate. Here's what's cool, man. This is what gives you hope for basketball, and this I'll leave it with you. I put that out 3 days ago. 1.7 million people have seen that tweet. And the cool thing is there's been 11,000, you know, likes. And I know that doesn't mean you agree with it, but it means it spreads out. And I've had coaches from every sport you can imagine, you know, contact me or send me a message about, man, that's awesome. And I actually reached out to Paul, got his number, was able to tell him thank you for impacting, you know, more than just Abilene Christian. So there's people out there doing it the right way. And that's what we've all got to keep remembering and keep spreading the good news of the game and how it touches lives and changes things. So,
absolutely. I think that's a great lesson for players to remember. I think it's a great lesson for coaches to remember that, yeah, that kid's contribution didn't show up in the box score, but you better believe that if he's that hyped up on the bench during a game, that he's bringing it in practice and he's making his teammates better. And he's the kind of kid that any coach wants in their team. And as you said, I think that's a great way to end it. And to everyone out there, we appreciate you checking out Four Quarters number seven with Greg White. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast presented by Head Start Basketball.